All right, if you join me in 1 Kings chapter 18, we're going to continue our study through the life and ministry of Elijah the prophet. We're at a portion in the account now where Elijah has been instructed by the Lord to return to Israel. Remember, he had, at the beginning of the story, he had been used by the Lord to deliver an unwelcomed word of prophetic judgment, in which there was an announcement that there was going to be no rain in the land for 3 years. Because there's going to be no rain, there would be no crops that would grow. There would be a severe famine that would ensue. And this was all because of the state, spiritually speaking, the state of affairs in the northern kingdom of Israel. Israel has been, from at this point in history, drifting from the Lord further and further, and it's come to a head now under the reign of King Ahab and his wife Jezebel. There is a giving over of the leadership of the nation, and the people of the nation in the most part have been following this progression toward greater and greater evil and idolatry. So we're now picking up 3 years after this announcement. The time has come for the famine to come to an end. The time has come for the Lord to restore rain to the land. And so he instructs Elijah to get up from this place of security and safety that the Lord had provided for him in the house of the widow of Zarephath, and to return to Israel and to confront once again King Ahab, like he had done at the beginning 3 years before. And so we're picking up in this account in verse 7 for today, and we're going to read verses 7 through verse 18, and we'll get as far as we can in this section this morning. This is starting, remember, with a confrontation, an interaction between Elijah and Obadiah. Obadiah here is the chief assistant to King Ahab. He's the steward who is in charge of the palace affairs of King Ahab. So verse 7, as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him, and Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is it you, my lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here." And he said, "How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord has not sent to seek you. And when they would say he is not here, he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, 'Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here.' And as soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he will kill me, although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. Has it not been told, my lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by fifties in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, 'Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he will kill me.' And Elijah said, 'As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today.' So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, 'Is it you, you troubler of Israel?' And he answered, 'I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals.'" All right, so in this circumstance, Obadiah is on an errand of King Ahab. The errand we saw in our study last time is a concern that Ahab has in this time of growing famine, that all of his horses and all of his mules are dying from a lack simply of grass to feed them. And so he, both Ahab and Obadiah, are going throughout the land of Israel searching for grass to feed the king's horses. And Ahab instructs Obadiah to split up from him, and they're each going to cover half of the territory. And so they split up, and as soon as they split up, verse 7 starts, and as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. So the circumstance as this scene unfolds is one that is meant to create a question in our minds, and it's a question that we've encountered more than once already in the story of Elijah. Is this a accidental or coincidental circumstance, or is this a providential circumstance? So Obadiah is a man who is on an errand of King Ahab, and as soon as he and King Ahab split up, it's like the next moment. Now, we don't know it's literally the next moment, and that doesn't technically matter, but in the story, as it's being now told to us, the next moment after the split from King Ahab, here's Obadiah on his way, simply doing his job as he's instructed by the king. And Elijah the prophet is right there to meet him in his pathway. And the question is, did they just happen to cross paths with each other? Or is there some deeper spiritual purpose in this meeting? Now, as the story unfolds, there's obviously a deeper spiritual purpose. And this is once again evidence of the providential hand of the Lord upon Elijah the prophet, and now for the benefit of Obadiah, in order to cross their paths at exactly the right moment, in exactly the right circumstance. We saw this providential element in one of our earlier studies when the Lord sent Elijah the prophet from the brook Kirith all the way down to Zarephath to meet with a specific widow that the Lord had instructed him to go live in her home, because the Lord was going to miraculously provide for Elijah and for the widow and her son. And as Elijah took this long journey by foot from the brook Kirith to the outskirts of the city of Zarephath, he arrives at the outskirts of the city at the exact moment where the widow is out there outside the city walls, gathering sticks in order to go make a fire to make one last meal, because she's ready to die of starvation, her and her son. And Elijah encounters her in that exact moment of her greatest need and her greatest desperation. We saw the hand of the Lord directing Elijah's steps all the way, the implication is, all the way from the brook Kirith to reach that next destination in his assignment from the Lord at the exact moment, in the exact location when the Lord wanted him there and where the Lord wanted him. We have that same element here. And it's just another indicator for us in the, it's kind of the backstory of the main story. The main story is what's going on here with Elijah and the king, what the Lord is doing in all of this circumstance. But the Lord is gracious to show us just how deeply he's involved in this story. This isn't just a circumstance that's unfolding. This is something that's happening with the Lord's fingerprint on each moment of the unfolding circumstance to get Elijah to this exact location. We don't know where out in the middle of the entire kingdom of Israel Obadiah is. He's not at the capital city. He's out there scouring the countryside for grass to feed the king's horses and mules. And wherever he happens to be in the countryside, suddenly, at the right moment, there's Elijah standing directly in his pathway. And only the Lord can put those things together in exactly that way. And so, in this providential moment, we can anticipate there's some big purpose in this meeting. There's some reason why this encounter happens. So Elijah announces himself to Obadiah, and he essentially says, you know, as Obadiah recognizes Elijah, and he says, "Is it you, my Lord Elijah?" Which is a good indicator right from the beginning, because Obadiah is addressing him in a deferential way, an honoring way. "Is it you, my Lord Elijah?" Even though technically Obadiah only has one Lord on a human level, and that would be King Ahab. Nevertheless, he's addressing Elijah as though Elijah is in charge of him, even though there's no formal connection between them. There's no formal relationship establishing Elijah's authority. Obadiah is recognizing the authority of the Lord present in Elijah the prophet. So he addresses him as, "Is it you, my Lord Elijah?" And Elijah announces, "It is me. Here I am. And I want you to go tell Ahab that I am here," meaning I'm back in Israel. I'm no longer the mystery missing prophet, because as Obadiah describes to Elijah in this interaction, Ahab's been searching for him high and low. He's gone everywhere. He's searched everywhere throughout his own kingdom, and he's even searched throughout the surrounding kingdoms, and he cannot find him. He's searching for him not to repent. Remember, he's searching for him for what purpose? He wants to end the problem that Elijah has provided for the nation. He wants to put an end to the trouble in Israel by ending the prophet that started this whole famine business. And so in this circumstance, he tells Obadiah to go and to announce himself to announce him to King Ahab. Now, what's interesting, though, about this is this, as I said, this providential meeting between Elijah and Obadiah occurs immediately after Obadiah and Ahab split pathways and go separate directions. The Lord could have just as easily had Elijah encounter Obadiah and Ahab when they were together, just before they split up. Or he could have had Elijah encounter Ahab instead of Obadiah right after they split up. So the king and his servant split and go opposite directions. Elijah appears to the servant, not to the king. And what he tells him is not, "Go and tell the king that I'm coming to see him." He tells him to deliver a message. "Go and tell Ahab that I am here." With the implication of what? If he wants to see me, have him come and see me. I'm not hiding anymore. I am here and I am ready to have an interaction with him. But if he wants an interaction with me, he needs to come my direction and come and see me. Now, this is completely flipped of the normal and expected protocol of interacting with the king of any kingdom in the ancient world, and this includes this particular kingdom. In the ancient world, if you wanted an audience with the king of a kingdom, you would be expected to go to the king and go through a process of presenting yourself before the king. And you would be brought, generally speaking, into the throne room of the king if you were allowed by the king's authority to even approach his presence in his person. And you would be in the entire process of approaching the king as he would be seated upon his throne. You would be normally in a position of submission or recognition, at the very least, of the superiority of the authority of the king that you're approaching. Elijah does exactly the opposite and is really what we would call nowadays flipping the script. And he is announcing himself to the king, but calling for the king to come and present himself to him. He's saying, "Go and tell Ahab that I'm here. And if he wants to see me," he doesn't say these words, but this is the clear implication, "he needs to come and present himself to me." And of course, as the story unfolds, even though there's this And we'll talk about this in a moment. There's this brief exchange between Elijah and Obadiah in which Obadiah is arguing with Elijah about what he's expected to do because of the danger associated with this assignment that is that Elijah is giving him. Nevertheless, at the end of the story, and we can skip down here, and we'll read again verse 15. And Elijah said, "As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. The idea is the king does come and present himself before Elijah. Now, is this because Elijah is just playing political games here with Ahab? Like, let's see who's the alpha dog in the room. Let's see who's the top guy. Let's see who's in charge of who here. He's not playing games, even political ones. What he's doing is he's establishing from the very beginning of this interaction that's about to unfold between him and Ahab, who's really in authority in this circumstance. And remember, Elijah's authority is not based in his personality, or it's not based in his position in the nation. His authority is based entirely in his unique and special assignment within the nation as the prophet of the Lord, as the one who represents the Lord. And so by requiring Ahab to come and present himself to him, rather than going and seeking Ahab out, he's establishing, even though Ahab is resistant to this concept, and we'll see just how deeply resistant he is in a minute, even though Ahab's resistant, nevertheless, the Lord remains in authority in Israel, not Ahab. And so the idea here is that Ahab is actually a man under authority, even though he has spent his entire career as king so far resisting that authority and even deeply rebelling against that authority. He's only king because the Lord appointed him as king, and the Lord remains in authority over him as king. And Elijah is establishing, really, in a sense, reestablishing that principle right from the beginning of the conversation that's going, and the exchange that's going to ensue between the two of them. Now, there's two important principles that are connected to why Elijah sets the meeting up in the way that he does. One of which, I'm going to take an example from history, and this example from history is, it's not establishing this principle, it's just an instruction about a principle that runs through all of history. How many of you have heard, and if you aren't familiar with him, it's not a big problem, but he's certainly a character from history that's worth reading about and knowing about. How many have heard of a famous preacher in church history by the name of Samuel Rutherford? Not a terribly well-known man, but I would say a significantly important one. He wrote about a principle in a book that was published during a time of the appointed authority of the land not recognizing the greater authority of the Lord. And the principle he wrote about was in a book called Lex Rex. Have you ever heard this terminology before? Lex Rex. I'll explain it. And what's really going on here and what's playing out in this exchange between Elijah and King Ahab is a question of, does the world work on a principle of lex rex, or does it work on a principle of rex lex? Now, these are two Latin terms, rex and lex. One means law, and the other means king. And so when you have a principle in human government in which the principle being lived out in that nation is a principle of rex lex, rex being the king, lex being law, what you're essentially saying in the way you govern the land is, whatever the king says becomes the law of the land. The idea is the king is the law. Whatever he says goes. And Ahab was conducting his role as king of Israel based upon the principle of Rex Lex. He believed that since he was the king, he was invested with the authority to do whatever he wanted to do, to rule any way that he saw fit. If he chose to compromise the principles of some ancient book containing the commandments of some God in heaven, so be it. He's the king. He can do what he wants to do. The other principle, the contrasting, conflicting principle, is the principle of Lex Rex, in which, in that principle, the way a nation should be governed. And we can ask the question, which nation should be governed this way? Every nation on the face of the earth should be governed by the principle of Lex Rex. And that principle is the law is king. The king is not the law. Now, of course, in a consideration of the law being king, you have to always ask the question, which law is our standard? What law do we follow? Do we follow man's law? Well, if you're following man's law, you're back to the principle of Rex Lex, the king making his own mind up about what the laws of the land are going to be. But if you're following the principle of the law as king, there is only one law that is duly authorized and recognized as having supreme authority over our lives as human beings. And those are the laws of God. Those are the principles and standards that God himself has established through revelation of his holy word. The law is king. The law is supreme authority, not any particular king. And the king is simply like Obadiah functioning in his relationship to Ahab. The king is only ever meant to be a steward of the Lord as the ultimate ruler of the nation. The king's number one job is not do what he wants, but to do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. And he is responsible to guard the standards of the Lord and to ensure in his leadership influence that the nation follows the Lord's standards, and not whatever the nation wants to do and not whatever the king wants to do. And so here in this circumstance, Ahab is living by a principle. This confrontation between Ahab and Elijah is a principle about the confrontation between two governing principles. Ahab believes and is convinced that Rex is Lex. The king is the law, and he happens to be the king. We shouldn't find it surprising that the one who is king would want to live according to the principle that whatever the king says goes. And, you know, I'm talking about kings here, but you understand as men that the Lord has appointed you to be, in a sense, a king of your own domain, king of your own household. You have the same principle that applies to your life and to your rule and to your leadership influence, just like the king of this nation does. Do you rule according to your own whims in your household, or do you rule according to the Lord's standards? Do you influence your household according to the ways of the Lord, or do you influence your household based upon what's best for you and what seems good in your own eyes? But this is the issue, and Elijah is now going to confront the king, and he is going to confront him with this opposing principle. And we're going to see which one is going to win out in this tug of war between conflicting governing principles. Now, I said there's two principles here that are at issue and are being revealed in this confrontation between Elijah and Ahab that's upcoming. The second one, after the Lex Rex or Rex Lex concept, is the issue of Ahab's apostasy. Remember, we've seen this before. We've looked at this in the earlier chapters of 1 Kings. We've set this up by looking at Ahab's track record before the story of the interaction with Elijah even starts. And his track record isn't just mediocre, and it's not just pretty bad. His track record so far is the worst king ever in Israel's history. And he's not the worst king ever because he's got bad economic policies. Or, you know, maybe he made a poor military judgment. You know, or maybe he's just, you know, he's just not the most popular king in history. He's the worst king ever, as we're going to see Elijah identify. And let's skip down to the end again of our section here and look at verse 18 once more. This is Elijah's declaration to Ahab. I have not troubled Israel, but you have and your father's house. Why? One reason only. Because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. There's one reason and one reason only that King Ahab is the worst king ever in Israel's history. He'd abandoned the commandments of the Lord. That's it. That's the defining issue of his administration. Now, if you had taken a poll of the people of Israel, they might not have been that thrilled with Ahab at that moment because they're in the midst of a famine. You know how people are in a nation. Anytime there's economic hardship, they're not happy with the leaders and they're going to vote in someone else next time if they have the opportunity, though the people didn't vote in those days. Nevertheless, the issue of what made him a bad king was the issue of his heart's relationship to the Word of God, period. And then the governing influence that he exerted upon the nation based upon his own broken relationship to God's revealed word. So the idea here is that Ahab's apostasy from the Lord and the word of the Lord has undermined any valid spiritual authority he would have as the ruler of that nation. He has no authority any longer. The only authority he has is now based in the horses and the mules that he's trying to keep alive by searching for grass. Just simply the physical power of his army. That's it. That's the only true authority he has any longer at this point. And so, of course, Elijah is not going to come and present himself to the king, recognizing even to a degree that the king has any valid royal authority any longer. And so he's going to require Ahab to come and present himself to him, because to present himself to him is to present himself to the true prophet of the Lord, who represents the word of the Lord that Ahab has abandoned and forsaken. He's having to present himself once again to the Word of God, as represented in physical form here by the presence, the returning presence of Elijah. Now, before we get to the actual confrontation, there, as we've identified this exchange between him and Obadiah, Obadiah is an interesting character. He's kind of a mixture. Some of my commentaries, and I've got the best commentaries available in the book of 1 Kings, some of the commentaries present Obadiah as a spiritual hero, and have only praise to describe Obadiah and his role in the story. Others see him as kind of a false believer or false figure who is living out a spiritual compromise because he remains in the service of an idolatrous and apostatized king. And he's faithfully serving that king in that circumstance. For myself, I don't see him as entirely a hero in the story, nor as entirely a bad guy in the story. I see him as kind of an interesting mixed character here. I think there's some wonderful qualities that Obadiah represents, and I think there's some not so wonderful qualities that he represents as well. The first thing we can be clear about with Obadiah, though, is that he's a true believer. A true believer. The description is this. In just a little bit before the section we started, look back at verse 3. And Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. You'll notice in our translation that the phrase, now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, is placed within parentheses. And you know in the original text there are no parentheses. Nevertheless, the translators have added them so that we can separate that declaration out from the simple, bare historical description that Obadiah is being called by Ahab to go and run an errand. What we have here is the author's brief spiritual commentary on the true spiritual condition of Obadiah in his circumstance. Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. This is not just someone's opinion of Obadiah. This is the Lord's description through the author of the book, who is writing under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. So if the Lord himself describes you, and if this would only be a true description of you, if the Lord himself described you as a man who feared the Lord greatly, would you be pleased with that description? Would you be good to go on the final day of judgment, knowing that it's coming your turn to stand before the throne and have your life evaluated from an eternal perspective, but you were confident and assured that at the end of the evaluation, these are the words that the Lord is going to say to describe you? You were a man in your life on earth who feared me greatly. Would you be willing to settle for that description, kind of as the label or the banner describing your life from an overview perspective? Me, I'd be thrilled to hear those words from the Lord. Tim, you were a man who feared the Lord greatly. That you should aspire to have that kind of description. But what's interesting about Obadiah is, in spite of being a true believer, in spite of the Lord himself describing him as a man who feared him greatly, he's not a perfect example to follow. Because while he's got on one side this strong quality of being a true believer, truly fearing the Lord greatly, nevertheless, when his moment to shine comes, and what I mean by moment to shine is, there are, and we've talked many times about this, not just in Elijah's story, but we saw this principle highlighted over and over again in our long study through the life of David. There are key moments that the Lord appoints for your life. You know, how many moments are there in your life total? If a moment represents, let's just say, 10 seconds of your life, how many moments are there in the course of your life? Just so many. We lose count. And they all tend to just kind of blend together. 10 seconds turns into another 10 seconds, which turns into another, and they all blend together. But there are defining moments that the Lord appoints for your life. There are certain 10-second moments where the Lord puts you in a specific circumstance, and your choices and your responses in those moments will define your life and determine the true value of your life, not based upon what some other person to the left or right of you thinks, but what the Lord himself thinks about you. And so here he is, a true believer, and he's got a good track record. It's not just that in the privacy of his own prayer closet, he has professed, "Lord, I believe in you and I fear you greatly." This man has put his own life on the line before this moment even arrives. How so? What had he done? He hid 100 of the prophets that the wicked queen Jezebel was slaughtering throughout Israel. He goes out and finds, because to hide them you have to first find them. He went out and found 100 of the true prophets of the Lord, gathered them together, went and found 2 separate caves, assigned them into groups of 50 to hide, 50 in one cave, 50 in another cave, and provided, at the bare minimum, a supply of ongoing bread and water for them to eat to sustain their lives during this time of great persecution of this wicked administration. And in doing all of that, if, this is the backstory, we're filling in the details that are implied by the text, even though they're not described directly, if Queen Jezebel or King Ahab had discovered that he was doing that, what do you think their reaction might have been? Their purpose was to slaughter those prophets. If he's hiding the prophets that they're trying to slaughter, would they have hesitated to slaughter him? The answer is, of course not. They would have slaughtered him and then immediately slaughtered the prophets that he was hiding if they had discovered what he was doing. So this is a man who truly fears the Lord, truly believes in the Lord. This is a man who has put his life on the line already to serve the Lord. And now comes his most shining moment of opportunity to serve the Lord. And in his greatest yet opportunity to serve the Lord, this is a moment in which he is going to act as the formal emissary of the true prophet of the Lord to go and to confront the wicked king and to basically say to him by implication, King, you need to come and present yourself to the prophet of the Lord and to the word of the Lord to give an account to the Lord through his prophet. What's Obadiah's reaction in this circumstance? He starts, of course, arguing with Elijah. Now, let me just say it this way. If you ever do or ever are granted an opportunity by the Lord to have a moment, a shining opportunity moment, to be in a sense, a team co-worker with a true servant of the Lord like Elijah clearly was. The last thing you want to do in that circumstance is argue with the assignment that you're given. Argue with the one who is giving you the assignment to come alongside and serve the Lord. In that moment in history, Elijah is the number one servant of the Lord on planet Earth. But think of the special privilege and opportunity being given to Obadiah. He's being given the blessing of being the number two servant of the Lord on the face of planet Earth. Why would the Lord give him such a great blessing? Because of his faithfulness in fearing the Lord greatly, and because he had gone to such lengths to risk his own life to hide the 100 prophets of the Lord. Therefore, the Lord is rewarding him with this further opportunity. And does Obadiah perceive it as a reward? No, he perceives it as a punishment. He's basically saying, his argument boils down to this with Elijah. Why are you punishing me? I have been faithful. I've feared the Lord from my youth. I have hid. Didn't you hear that I hid the 100 prophets? Where were you when I was hiding the 100 prophets? And now you just want to punish me by sending me to the king with a message that he doesn't want to hear from my lips. And if I do deliver that message to him, he says it three times in this exchange. He says it in verse 9, verse 12, and verse 14. Let's read those three back to back. Verse 9. How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? Verse 12. As soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you, I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab and he cannot find you, he will kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. And then verse 14. And now you say, go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here and he will kill me. What does he repeat three times? He's going to kill me.
That's it.
That's what's going to happen here. He's going to kill me. You don't know Ahab like I know Ahab. I serve this guy. I'm in the palace all day long. He kills people right and left. You don't realize. You've been off hiding with the widow of Zarephath having a merry time. I've been here on the front lines. It's serving the Lord in the palace. But now you want to kill me by sending me on this assignment. So what's the mixture here? He truly knows the Lord. He truly fears the Lord. He's risked his life already. What's the holdup here? The holdup here is Obadiah is essentially saying, okay, there ought to be a limit to how far the Lord will require a man to go in serving him. And I've already met that limit. I've gone to that line of serving the Lord in a way as to sacrifice my life or risk the sacrifice of my life. And now you're calling me to go back there again. That's just not right. You don't have that right to tell me to do that. And essentially, he's implying the Lord doesn't have that right. So here's a man who truly believes in the Lord, truly fears the Lord, has truly served the Lord, and yet his sanctification is not complete. He has room to grow here. He's not fully mature yet in his faith. He's a man of faith, but he's a man of faith mixed with fear. And down deep, in spite of the fact that, you know, when you see a man willing to risk his own life to serve the Lord, you think, oh, he's reached the limit of Christian maturity. You can't go any further than that. Well, yeah, absolutely, you can go further than that. You can go as far as the Lord calls you to go. Whatever your assignment from the Lord is. And if at any point in your personal assignment from the Lord, you find yourself arguing with the representative of the Lord or the Lord himself, as, for instance, Moses did when he was sent back to Egypt by the Lord. Anytime you find yourself arguing with the one who represents the next chapter of your life assignment from the Lord, you can be confident and sure that you're on the wrong side of that equation. And there's not going to be any escaping from this. But I do like what Elijah does, and I'm sure this isn't just Elijah feeling sorry for Obadiah. I don't think he felt sorry for him at all. I think Elijah was a man who was living out his assignment wholeheartedly, 100%. And so he was calling Obadiah to that same kind of wholehearted commitment. But I like how Elijah showed just how gracious the Lord can be and is when we most need him to be. And here Obadiah needed to experience the Lord's graciousness. That graciousness is revealed in verse 15. After Obadiah argues with him three times and essentially says, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And Elijah says this to him, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. Now, the least of what Elijah just did in that communication was he promised Obadiah. Because remember, Obadiah's concern wasn't just that he had to deliver the message. His big concern was, I'm going to go and deliver the message, but while I'm gone, the Spirit of God's going to take you somewhere else. And I'm going to come back with the king to meet you, or the king's going to come and meet you, and you're going to be gone, and then the king's going to be ticked off at me, and he's going to take it out on me. And so Elijah says, promising him, no, when the king comes, I will be here to meet him. In essence, he's declaring to Obadiah, this is my assignment. My assignment is to be here to meet with the king. But he doesn't just promise this to Obadiah. He does something even stronger than giving him a promise. He gives him what was called in biblical times an oath. He takes an oath. When he says these words, as the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, that's the form of an oath. It's their equivalent, only even greater in significance and meaning, to what we used to do as a culture and a society in our court system when you would come to the witness stand and there are many courts that don't do this any longer, but they would hold out a Bible and say, before you take the witness stand, place your right hand where? Place your right hand on this book, on this Bible. Or I forget, maybe it's left hand, and you raise your right hand and take this oath. You know, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. Now, of course, since the Lord is not being given the place in our society that he formerly was, you may not see that formula portrayed in our justice system quite the same way any longer, depending on the court. But the point is the same. It's a way of placing what you're about to do and say into a special category of accountability, meaning I am making myself accountable before the Lord that what I'm telling you I'm going to do, I'm going to do. So Elijah graciously gives Obadiah the most serious assurance that he will not be missing when Ahab comes to meet him. He will be there to meet him because this is his assignment from the Lord. All right, that leads us up to verse 16, and we will spend a minute here considering this interaction between Ahab and Elijah. Let's read those three verses again. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel? Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals." So the question that's the back question, the undercurrent of the backstory going on here is, Ahab has not seen Elijah for how long now?
3 years.
3 years. Remember, Elijah, as we started our study, Elijah was sent by the Lord to go and confront King Ahab and to proclaim this coming judgment, this judgment of no rain in the land for the next 3 years except by his word, and the implication of an ensuing severe famine. And then immediately after delivering that word, what happens to Elijah? He's sent by the Lord to the brook Cherith, which is camping way out in the wilderness. And then after spending some time there, undiscovered by King Ahab, he's then sent from the brook Cherith to a foreign land to the widow of Zarephath. And he remains there until the end of the three-year appointed time of drought and famine. He's returned now at the end of the 3 years. Ahab hasn't seen him for 3 years. Here's the real question. If we're reading it from the perspective of, we're looking at Ahab through Elijah's eyes, in a sense, in this encounter. And the question is, have you learned anything in the last 3 years? Ahab. The Lord's been teaching a Bible study for the last 3 years. Not a Bible study like we're doing this morning, where we're all, you know, pleasantly sitting down after nice full bellies after David's wonderful breakfast that he cooked us this morning. And we've all got our Bibles open in front of us, and we're reading through the revealed words of the Lord. The Lord was teaching a different kind of Bible study, but it was a three-year-long Bible study. I mean, you know how it is. We joke around about how I go long sometimes in my Bible studies. The Lord was teaching Ahab an unending three-year-long Bible study through the circumstances that he was living and enduring, dealing with, unavoidably. He couldn't stop it from happening. And it was a simple study, simple principle. You pay attention to me, I'll pay attention to you. You disregard me, and I'll disregard you. That's the lesson the Lord was teaching Ahab. And underneath those two complementary principles was a deeper principle, which is, who's in charge here? Is it you, Ahab? Is it Rex is Lex? Or is it Lex is Rex? Which is it? Which principle are you living by? Have you had your eyes open in these last 3 years? Have you gained anything from a three-year famine and drought? You know, when the Lord appoints judgment, we've talked about this principle before. We saw it play out in the life of David in a dramatic way more than once. When the Lord appoints for your life some form of judgment, he never appoints judgment for you, or in the case of a believer, disciplinary circumstances or experiences. He never appoints that simply because he's mad and he wants to hurt you. He appoints it for you to gain something from it, for you to learn something from what you're going through, for you to have your eyes opened to gain wisdom and understanding so that you can alter by his grace and graciousness, you can alter your pathway from where you've been heading to where you should be heading. That's always, always, always the purpose of the Lord in judgment and in discipline. And so the question for Ahab is, have you gained anything from these 3 years' experience? And the reality is, we can answer for Ahab with a resounding and clear, nope, haven't learned a single thing. I'm just as hard-hearted and stubborn-headed and stiff-necked as I was before you appointed for this drought and famine. And in fact, I'm more hard-hearted now after 3 years of experiencing this than I was before it even started. The experience has only made me more stubborn. It hasn't softened my heart a single bit. There, what do you think about that, you troubler of Israel? That's the backstory of what Ahab's response. He's been thinking, Ahab has, most likely. I know I would, in his shoes. He's been thinking about Elijah every day for the last 3 years. Elijah's been gone. But this, he knows this. This all started that one fateful day when Elijah came and talked to me. And I can't get what he said out of my head. And I can't get him out of my mind. And he's been thinking about him. And now he's actually, even though he hates his guts, he's formed kind of an affectionate nickname for him. Elijah is now, in his mind, the troubler of Israel. Now, you know, we're meant to ask the question, even though Ahab doesn't. Was Elijah the cause of the trouble in Israel? And Elijah's own response, not just defending his own personal reputation, but defending ultimately the principle that the Lord is enacting in all of these circumstances, defending the word of the Lord, defending the laws of God, and the consequences that are attached to disregarding and rebelling against God's laws, Elijah responds to this not-so-affectionate nickname being proclaimed to him. Oh, you, is that you, you troubler of Israel? And he responds with a simple and bare opposing declaration. I have not troubled Israel. I'm not the cause of your trouble. Well, in one sense, he absolutely was, wasn't he? If the trouble is simply the consequence, if the trouble is simply the price that has to be paid for disregarding the word of the Lord, then Elijah certainly is the troubler of Israel. Because he's the one that proclaimed the judgment of the drought which ensued with the famine that followed. But the issue is, what's the real cause of the trouble? The trouble is not simply that there is judgment when you disregard the word of the Lord. The real cause of the trouble is the disregard of the word of the Lord. That's the cause of the trouble in Israel. And this isn't just, oh, this is an exceptional moment in Israel's history. It was never like this before, and it'll never be like this after. This is the same story that's told over and over and over again from the Garden of Eden through the book of Malachi. And what is that story? The Lord is gracious to reveal his ways to his people, and he calls them to respond with simple lives of obedience and faithfulness. And when they disregard him, by disregarding his word, he is, in a sense, forced to teach them that you cannot, dare not disregard him and his word. There will be consequences to pay. And judgment follows time after time after time after time throughout their long and difficult history. But it's all tied not to the circumstance of the trouble, of the consequence. It's all tied to the heart failure to receive and obey and faithfully keep the words and the commandments of the Lord. So Elijah says to him, I have not troubled Israel, but you have. Who's the true troubler here? It's you, King Ahab. You are the man who's troubling Israel. And not just you, your father's house has troubled Israel. Can you imagine the boldness of the prophet to say this to the face of the king who has an entire army at his disposal? You're the cause of all the trouble here. And not just you, your father's house. You and your father are the cause of this trouble. This is tied, of course. Let's look back for a moment. We read this once before, but 1 Kings 16, 25 and 26. Omri here is in view. And who is Omri? Elijah's, Ahab's father. Omri did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord and did more evil than all who were before him. When I asked you earlier, wouldn't it be great to, on the final day, to have your life labeled as one who feared the Lord greatly? Now, put yourself in Omri's shoes, and this is how the Lord evaluates you, and this is how he labels your life after evaluating your entire life. This is what your life means. You did more evil than anyone that was before you. For he walked in all the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and in the sins that he made Israel to sin, provoking the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their idols. Now the rest of the acts of Omri that he did and the might that he showed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And Omri slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab his son reigned in his place. We already saw, from another later testimony of Ahab, that he exceeded even his father Omri in his own expression of wicked leadership influence in the nation. So here's the family story. Omri, worst king ever, succeeded by Ahab, even worse. And so when Elijah says these words, I have not troubled Israel, but you have in your father's house, and the summary of the trouble that they caused for Israel, it all boils down to this. He doesn't say, you didn't have a good enough economic plan for the nation. You weren't a strong enough military leader. You know, you didn't care enough for the people. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. All the things that we tend to evaluate politicians and nations' leaders by. Elijah identifies he had one great flaw, Ahab did. And Omri, his father, had the same flaw. It was a shared flaw. One flaw and one flaw ultimately and only mattered. You have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. The Baals, of course, were the false gods, the idols of the nations surrounding them. You have abandoned the commandments of the Lord. Now, we've seen this principle before, but let's turn back and end our study here. This is the real story of what's going on. Deuteronomy chapter 28. I'm going to read just a single verse, though the whole chapter is worth reading in this context. Deuteronomy 28, in fact, the whole book of Deuteronomy, plays a very important role in God's communication with his people. It's at a key moment in Israel's history. It's at the end of the 40-year wilderness journey. They're now, as Deuteronomy is being communicated through Moses to the people of the Lord, they're now camped as a nation at the very end of their 40-year journey through the Sinai wilderness. They're camped literally at the shores of the River Jordan. And once they cross that river, they're leaving forever the wilderness behind, and Egypt even further behind. And they're crossing into what the Lord described to them as the land of promise, where his purpose for them could potentially be fulfilled. And before he allows them to cross that boundary line between wilderness and promise fulfillment, he has all of the people arrange themselves in a specific way, and he communicates to them once more this core principle from his revealed word to them, what we know as the laws, the commandments of the Lord. And in this particular chapter, what he does is he reminds them that in this relationship that the Lord has formed with them, that we call a covenant, there is accountability to that relationship. There are requirements imposed upon those who enjoy or want to enjoy the blessings and benefits of the covenant. And if they disregard the requirements of the covenant, what we call the laws, the commandments of God, then they will certainly encounter and experience the consequences of that disregard. We're going to read just one verse from Deuteronomy 28. The whole chapter is devoted to describing in the first 14 verses the wonderful blessings that the Lord promises to obedience and faithfulness to his commandments. And then in verses 15 all the way through verse 68, the Lord details in what we would consider to be almost exhausting detail of the many consequences they're going to experience for their disregard of his commandments when they do rebel against them. But look at verse 15. This is the turning point in the chapter. The Lord speaking through Moses. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. And then he spends from verse 16 through verse 68 detailing the curses that will overtake them. And specifically among those is detailed the curse of no rain upon the land and ensuing severe famine, which is exactly where Ahab, king of Israel, found himself at this critical moment in the history of the nation. All right, we'll end our study there this morning. And Lord willing, I will be back from Kenya a month from now, and we will pick up with the call of Elijah to assemble the false prophets of Baal for a dramatic confrontation that will take place on Mount Carmel so that the Lord can display once and for all who is the true Lord of Israel. God bless you, men.
Do you have a title?